This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is William McDonough, an American architect and founder of William McDonough and Partners. Bill also co-founded McDonough Braungart Design Chemistry and with Michael Braungart co-authored the book Cradle to Cradle, Remaking the Way We Make Things, a seminal manifesto of green design. William McDonough is here today to tell us about his most recent book, The Upcycle, Beyond Sustainability, Designing for Abundance, co-authored with Michael Braungart and published in 2013. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you.
What led you to write your book? What is your goal?
Well, I think we're tired of hearing how the world is getting worse and worse and the limits are so great that we're collapsing as a species. And I think this idea of being less bad is obviously an important one, but I think the really important one now is to say, if we keep doing what we're doing, even if we do it less badly, we're still in deep trouble. It's time to turn around and imagine a 100% positive future and drive with our design as the first signal of human intention toward that. So we should be, of course, less bad, but wouldn't it be marvelous if we started to really work on what was more good.
Would you remind us of the concept of cradle to cradle and the principles you have articulated for good design?
Cradle to cradle, in comparison to cradle to grave, which seems to be the paradigm of modern industrial production, says that instead of just take, make, waste, we eliminate the concept of waste. And we don't just try to reduce waste, we try to see everything as food. So everything is food for something else. And the question becomes, what's next for it? And can we design things that are safe for biology, safe for the environment, or safe for industry, which means we get them back, even if they're difficult materials in the biosphere, like lead, you know, as a solder or something, it can still be used in an electronics as long as it's not released to the biosphere, for example. And we call those technical nutrients. Think about metals and plastics, things like that, that we could use endlessly. It calls for a kind of reverse logistics. We want things back so we can deploy them again properly and safely. It has new business models. For example, you can lease things instead of own them because then the materials know where they're going next because the company that made the washing machine would be happy to have it back and get their materials back or the carpet or whatever. And then we talk about using renewable energy, having clean water, and treating people fairly. And those are the characteristics of a cradle-to-cradle product.
Just as a specific example, what are the drawbacks of, for example, using PET or plastic bottles to make fleece?
Well, in the upcycle, we look at the idea of recycling is often not really recycling. It's downcycling. We talked about that in Cradle to Cradle, but here we amplify the question of could we make it better when it comes back? If you look at a clear water bottle, it's food-grade plastic, and it's clear. Now, it may have some residues from catalytic reactions that are not perfect and things like that. But we can remove those in the recycling and upcycle it. In other words, we can make it even better than it was before when we put it back into circulation in society, upcycle it. Most of the time, though, these things go off to become a park bench or a flower pot or something and get mixed with things because they're confused and hybridized with labels and other polymers or strange contents. And so it's downcycling. And so when you look at a polyester bottle that becomes a fleece, for example, it could be, depending on who's doing it, certainly, contaminated by the dyes and the finishes and the things that are used to make it into a fabric. And then people add zippers and labels and signs and things on them. And those fleeces are no longer able to be recycled into clear food-grade polymer. So it's actually downcycled in quality. And it may even have these residues in it, which are suboptimal for contact with human skin.
Would you elaborate on the implications of poor design?
Well, I like to see design as the first signal of human intention. When you wake up in the morning and you have designs on the world, it's your intentions. And the question becomes, you know, what are our intentions for the world? Is it to be, you know, less bad in a world that we pollute? You know, if that's the best we can do? And so I see so many designs that are just trying to be less bad, buildings that will reduce their energy consumption a little bit, feel like that's as much as they can do, or that kind of thing. And yet, there's an opportunity to design buildings that make energy from renewable sources that's useful beyond that which is required by the building. So it becomes like a tree. It gives back. So, you know, what's a better design? Something that destroys the world a little more slowly, or something that actually is fecund and acts like a tree? So what is good? Is good being less bad? Or would good be something that is productive and a positive contributor, not just a less damaging thing? That's one. And then the other is, I think, the question of what's next for things hasn't really come, except to the extent that we've had planned obsolescence after the Second World War, where we look at things that are, you know, we expect to go out of fashion, so that what's next will replace it. And that's led to planned obsolescence, conspicuous consumption, stuff like that. Well, the real question is, what's next? If you design a car or a computer, wouldn't it be beautiful if we could design what's next into it, so that when you finish with it, because I don't expect the computer I have to be the one I will be using in 3 or 4 years, 5 years, whatever. And so wouldn't it be great if what's next was designed into it, so it can go back to the electronics universe and become new computers without contaminating the biosphere or requiring us to do more mining or expose children to various heavy metals and so on and so forth. So plastics, metals, things like that can be designed for their next use. And organic substances like cotton shirts or sheets or paper can be designed to go back to the biosphere safely, because we plan what's next into what's now.
Well, you've been alluding to this, but what do you mean specifically by upcycle?
Well, people have interpreted upcycle differently. We've gone ahead and used it because we'd like to put a frame on it about quality. We would like to think of upcycling as things get better. And some people think that turning a water bottle, a lowly water bottle, into a fleece is upcycling it, because you've increased its utility into, you know, a piece of clothing from a water bottle. But that's really a use change, and the materials in that case are getting contaminated. So we would call that actually a form of downcycling. Or some people are putting zippers on juice boxes and calling them wallets and thinking that's upcycling, because you've made a wallet out of a lowly juice box. But the materials, you just added a zipper to aluminum, paper, and plastic. These things will never be recycled and have really nowhere to go next. So that's sort of side cycling or downcycling. So for us, upcycling means, wouldn't it be great if we get back things that are suboptimal and make them better as we put them back into human resourcefulness? And so we think of the idea of things being endlessly resourceful, so that we can continuously reuse them and that their quality is going up. If you took a building and you renovate it, it gets better. It becomes renewably powered. The materials are cleaner. The air is better. The materials have systems that can use them in the future more commodiously and so on. So we look at the idea of endless resourcefulness of things, of energy, and of people and their creativity.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is William McDonough, co-author with Michael Brongard of the book, The Upcycle, Beyond Sustainability, Designing for Abundance. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What do you consider the drawbacks of setting goals such as zero carbon emissions or zero waste?
The only real drawback is that they may not create the fertility of the human imagination that we're going to need to pull out of our tailspin as a species on the planet. Because, you know, carbon, for example, is a material. And when we say we have an energy problem, we don't. We have plenty of energy, as we can see from shale gas or things like that being discovered all the time. That's not the problem. The problem is a material problem. We have carbon, a material, in the atmosphere and at beyond, you know, 350 parts per million and so on. And as it rises above these numbers where it was propitious for the development of our species and our climate, the way we've evolved for it and developed our economies and our whole way of inhabiting the planet, what we've done is put a material in the wrong place. See, carbon, historically through the eons, has been accruing into soil from the atmosphere, which is where the oil comes from, for example. And the idea is carbon, a material, from the atmosphere into soil through leaves of trees and so on, biota. And here we are taking ancient biota, oil, fossil fuels, and putting it back into the atmosphere, the opposite of what nature's been doing for a very long time. So in the last 200 years, we've just sort of reversed what nature had planned for carbon. So when people say they'd want to reduce their carbon, that's really a good thing to be doing, but is it adequate? So to say zero carbon, you know, is a really useful idea, but all you've really said is what you don't want to be. And in the end, I don't know that's creative enough. That would be like getting in a taxi and going, quick, I'm not going to the airport. What are you saying? Oh, we don't want to be carbon. Now, we find it quite delightful to say, fine, reduce your carbon in the atmosphere. It's very useful and a good thing to be doing and a good trajectory. But if your goal is zero, put that down below the line and say, this is what humans consider bad. These are our values. See, less bad is not good. Less and bad are not numbers. And negative numbers multiplied, making it positive. It's not like that. It's less as a relationship, bad as a human value. So being less bad is, by definition, bad, just less so. So if all we're going to do is be bad, but less so, we haven't given the children the signal of what it might be to be good. So I prefer companies that we work with, for example, that say we're going to be 100% clean energy, renewably powered in most instances, because the issue is really, can we have clean energy? And so the question then becomes, you know, there are people who think that nuclear power is clean because it's not involving carbon. But then we have to look at the use of nuclear fission and radioactive waste and ask ourselves, is this a form of energy that we really wish to see? Or do we want to go straight for the renewables from the sunshine, also a form of nuclear energy? And the reactor is fusion. It's 93 million miles away. It's 8 minutes, and it's wireless. So make your choices. But let's move on to clean energy future and stop putting carbon in the atmosphere. And let's get creative and inventive and intentional about doing that. And it's amazing to watch the renewable energy universe develop with people who are well-meaning putting their creativity to that exercise.
Would you speak about how these concepts apply to toxins? Again, in your book, you state that humans don't have a pollution problem. They have a design or materials in the wrong place problem.
Well, I mean, a toxin is defined various ways, and one of which is, you know, a material in the wrong place. Lead in a river or in a child's mouth in a toy is lead in the wrong place. Now, is lead a good or a bad? Well, if it's in the biosphere and it's a neurotoxin, I'd call that a bad. And so we worry about that. If lead is in a computer and it's in solder and it's been carefully managed throughout its whole extraction and use period and recovery period, it can be a nutrient for technology. As long as it doesn't see the biosphere, it's just a technical nutrient. We can see the same with various kinds of plastics and so on. So what is a toxin? Also, toxins get defined as dose and duration. So how much of it can you be exposed to for how long before it's actually damaging? And that becomes interesting because just about everything in that case would be kind of toxic, if you think about it, at the wrong dose and duration. Water would be highly toxic to you if I surrounded you with it for 6 minutes. You would drown, and it would be a lot of water, wrong dose, 6 minutes, wrong duration. So the question then becomes, if we're going to see cadmium to make red dye on a shirt, and it's a carcinogen and a heavy metal, and why would I use that to make something red? And if somebody said, well, you're not using enough of it to give the kid cancer in that shirt, I'd ask myself, well, what happens when that shirt's in a landfill? Or what happens if it gets to an incinerator? Or why are we putting carcinogens in the first place when we know 18 other ways to make this bright red without anything harmful? So then it becomes a question of design and intentionality. So I don't just want to come in and scrape through at some low dose and duration. But then if you aggregate in society and throw it all together, what do you end up with? Cadmium contaminated stuff. Or if you look at cadmium, why would I have nickel-cadmium batteries where kids could get to them with a hammer? You know, on the other hand, if I have cadmium telluride solar collector on a roof and I'm leasing it and it still belongs to the company and they know where it is and they're going to come back and get it and reuse the material safely, well, then okay. So it really does matter. The context matters, the materials matter, and we want to know down to the parts per million, parts per billion, what things are made of and why they can't be positively defined. And that's cradle to cradle and the upcycle.
What is the best approach to going about designing a cradle-to-cradle product?
Well, there's a protocol that Michael Braungart and I have released into the public domain for a cradle-to-cradle product. It's 3 inches of scientific criteria. But if you go to the Cradle-to-Cradle Products Innovation Institute that we created at the request of Governor Schwarzenegger and lots of people who said, will you please take your private program you use to help manufacturers make smarter products and watch their continuous improvement, could you give that into the public domain? And we've done that. And so it exists. It's in San Francisco. It's an office in the Netherlands. And it's just beginning, and it'll be moving into the world. And they will have access to this. They have it. And then there are assessors who we're training around the world who can help assess products and bring the assessments to the Institute for Certification. So that's the beginning of that, we hope, revolution.
Why do you argue that values rather than metrics should be placed first in designing products? How does this make the outcome different?
We find if all you have is measurement and metrics, then you can get to goals. You start with metrics, and then you come up with tactics, strategies, and you set goals. So if your metrics are, how much carbon do I release? That's it. Then you say, oh, okay, my tactic are change a light bulb, you know, or drive a few less miles. My strategy is, you know, get everybody to do some of this in my community. And your goal is 20% reduction of carbon by 2020. Well, is that going to save us? Apparently not. If on the carbon question, for example. So if that's your energy strategy, to start with the existing measurement and then go somewhere. When you look at the great enterprises that have been created in the last 25 years, 30 years, especially in the internet, for example, I don't think that Wikipedia was benchmarking the Encyclopedia Britannica. You know, they weren't saying, we're going to have twice as many entries. They're basically opening it up to, you know, allowing it to expand it on its own. You know, it's like Google didn't limit itself to, like, we'll have twice as many searches as a dictionary, you know. So if you start with a measurement, you can get to goals, but you can't really get to your human values. Those might be different. So what I use in my values are, how do I love all the children of all species for all time? That's the question I'll ask. So if I'm designing a building or a product or setting up a commercial program or something I'm doing with a government or designing a city, I look at it, start right there. And all of a sudden, I have a building I'm designing that's going to restore ancient butterflies to a community because I'm using them for the lobby decoration as butterflies hatching. That's the proposal. So you go to work in the morning, you watch butterflies hatch, and then the weekend the kids can come let them out. And that's instead of, you know, some kind of tree you have to water. So it's just a different way of thinking. And so those are your values. But I can apply the same thing then. If I start with that, then I go to my principles, which might be treat people fairly, eliminate the concept of waste. And I wrote something called the Hanover Principles in 1992. We gave them their summit as a gift. And then I go to my goals. And then I go to strategies, tactics, and I end up with metrics. So, you know, we've designed an auto plant that uses natural systems and bird habitats to purify the water on the site instead of conventional chemical plants and pipes. And it saved the company $35 million over conventional engineering. And with cars at a 4% margin, it's equivalent of an order for $900 million worth of cars. I mean, there's your metrics. Done. Over and out. Econ 101. But if I had started by saying, I'm going to reduce my benchmark metrics of how many chemical plants I need to purify the water, how many chemicals and so on, how many pipes, and I just said I'm going to reduce them, and my goal is to reduce them because that's my measurement world, I wouldn't have left that world of pipes and chemicals to go to the natural world and say, are there things here that produce habitat for lots of species that could also purify the water? And guess what? It ended up being a quarter of the price.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is William McDonough, co-author with Michael Brongart of the book The Upcycle, Beyond Sustainability, Designing for Abundance. Well, you've started speaking about some of the projects that you've helped implement in terms of Cradle to Crater. Would you also speak about your project with the U.S. Postal Service?
USPS, with Anita Bisotto, quite a number of years ago, said, what would it mean to Postal Service packaging if we could start to look at them this way? And so we've reviewed dyes, inks, the papers, the polymers being used for USPS packaging, even the stamps in America. And they've been through Cradle to Cradle certification. So that basically when you're looking at, say, paper, you're asking, well, if somebody takes the box that someone used to send you something, and when they end up in the paper stream, wouldn't it be nice if those inks and all those materials were thought about from ecological and human health so we have a safe recycled cardboard system instead of undefined chemistries? Because a lot of these inks and coatings and glues and, you know, the adhesives and the plastic films that go on top of things and all that, they corrupt the recycled paper streams. The plastic labels, you know, can't be recycled with the cardboard. The inks are undefined, and they come from various places without anybody knowing exactly what's in them, and so on and so forth. So USPS took a leadership role, and at revenue neutral, that's a very important part of this, is the economics have to work for everybody. That's what drives the system as well. So, you know, it doesn't cost more. It just is it's better quality. That's what we're looking for here.
And what was the final result of your project with the Postal Service?
I think a little over 2 billion things that were cradle-to-cradle certified. Stamps, things like that.
What were some of the challenges you found in doing the project?
Well, it's always challenging, and it always involves continuous improvement. The work never ends. The challenges are essentially to line up the supply chains and make them enjoy the process, because it requires people to think. That's a challenge for a lot of people because they're competing in a marketplace. It's very dynamic. They have ways they do things. They have trade secrets. They don't want to tell their competitors how they make their product for this customer. The customer's going to have to say, we prefer. And then people are going to say, what is it you prefer? And we're going to have to work with them down into their deep chemistry and formulations to help it get accomplished. We're going to have to work until the price points make sense so they can be executed effectively. There's a lot to it. It's not that simple. I think the value set, though, is pretty simple. It's like, how do we do the right thing the right way? If people are looking for cars that are super energy efficient, you're making big Hummers, you might be making the wrong vehicle, so you're not making the right thing for the market. And so what we're asking now is not just, can I make something you sell in the market, but what is the right thing to do by society, by the environment, by the economy, and how do we bring our jobs back? How do we make safe, healthy things that future generations will praise us for having made instead of bemoaning our behaviors? You know, how do we do that? How do we make assets for future generations while we produce productive businesses in the future? That's really the kind of question that we're asking, and it's really fun to do.
Would you speak about your work in Beijing and how upcycle concepts can be applied to cities and growth?
For China, their growth is so dramatic. They've basically, by joining the market economy in the last few decades, but with the carbon fuel as the backbone, what you see is they've done in the last few decades the amount of polluting that took us in the United States a couple hundred years. So, as you probably have heard recently, they're having trouble in Beijing even seeing each other across the street. I don't know if you'd want to move your family to Beijing to live, but there are a lot of people who won't go there anymore. And then, on top of that, because the Chinese are moving from the country to the cities at a dramatic clip, Beijing is expected to double in size in the next decade. And that's big time. These are tens of millions of people we're talking about. So, how do you do that if you're already kind of out of water and your air quality is already like a fog of soot and dust? Well, it's tough. So what I'm looking at there, and for other cities, is how to ask people who are going to do new things if they could help regenerate the old things. So essentially, if you want to build 400 apartments outside of Beijing as it expands, wouldn't it be interesting if you could go into the old city and mine it for the energy and water you need, and maybe at twice what you require? Let's just look at it this way. If you said 400 apartments here, you go in and you find buildings that are immensely inefficient, use more water per capita than they need by a factor of two, for example, energy by a factor of two. Go in and make those buildings energy efficient and water efficient, which is very simple, just have gross metering per capita consumption. Drop those to the extent that you drop them, you know, below half, and then you can use half of that even to power your new building. So in the end, the city doubles and it reduces its energy requirement by 25% in water. That way, no more new dams, no more new pipes, no more new power plants. In fact, less. And everybody gets better together. Then also you'll find the market works, because the cheapest way to get your energy permission, in effect, is to go mine it at the cheapest place. So the worst buildings will be fixed first. That's interesting. And then also, as the efficiency gets mined, it starts to get to the point where you could put in solar collectors on the new buildings just as cheaply as going back in and looking at buildings to renovate, because the solar is collapsing in price now. We've seen solar collectors have gone from beyond $10 a square foot 15 years ago, and this equals a watt of installed power, to 80 cents. So at a certain point, you just go to renewables. Is cheaper than fooling around with all the other stuff. So it's a strategy to drive towards renewables that are cost effective while making everything that we have and reducing its demand side as practical as we can, because that's usually the cheapest thing to do first, be efficient. But then the question is, when do we become effective? And you can combine those two. So we reduce the demand of what we don't want, and we increase the supply of what we do want.
What do you think would most help upcycle thinking become more prevalent?
I think commercial success is a really useful engine of change. I work with commerce. We find that if businesses can make money and people get jobs and the world gets better, it's faster, just about any other incentive. So we drive toward commercial success for people who do this. And it's quite built in a strange way to the quality improvement because it's a nicer product, typically, and we typically reduce costs because if you don't have regulations because you don't need them, well, my goodness, you know, there are a lot of businesses who say, you know, we don't like to be regulated because it adds cost. We agree, and we don't think they should be regulated. But what we mean by that is, wouldn't it be nice if there was nothing they were doing that required society to worry about them, thereby regulating them? So by designing with safe, healthy materials in safe, healthy ways, the regulators are happy to see you instead of scared. So it's a way of designing into that notion, because a regulation is actually necessary from society to preserve people and their health and safety in many cases, but it's also a signal of design failure. It sends a signal. You are making something society is afraid of, you see? So if you can design things out of safe, healthy materials, your regulations start to go away, and that saves you money. So it's the right reason to not be regulated. It's because there's nothing to regulate, because nobody's afraid of you anymore. So that's important. And then the other is to make money, because if we design buildings where people are much more productive, you know, if a building costs, you know, X dollars a square foot, the cost of people in the building is 10 times that. So if people can be more productive, one-tenth more productive because they like being there and they're healthy and they're engaged in their work in productive ways, 10%, it pays for the whole building in 1 year. What? It pays for the whole building in 1 year. So it's not just saving an energy bill or something. So the people matter. And all of a sudden, leaders in business and so on recognize that. And so these buildings become immensely productive. The products become delightful, and they're sought by customers, because why wouldn't you want a baby product that was healthy for your baby instead of toxic, for example? So we use the money, follow the money. It's very effective. But, you know, honor the environment and honor society at the same time, of course. So we want the three qualities. We want social fairness. We want ecological intelligence and goodness, so we have a beneficial footprint on the planet. And we want productive enterprises that engage people locally in employment and capital formation.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
There's hope. And what we need now most vigorously is everyone's creativity that's principled. We need principled creativity. We need to re-examine all the things we've done in the last 200 years and say, which ones of them do we consider propitious for everyone? Which one of them do we consider damaging? Do we accept the concept of less pollution? Why are we accepting the concept of pollution at all? Now that we know that things are suboptimal, why wouldn't we sort of pull our socks up and get back to work and just say we don't do it that way anymore?
Well, thanks so much for being here, Bill. You were just listening to William McDonough, co-author with Michael Brongard of the book The Upcycle, Beyond Sustainability, Designing for Abundance, published in 2013 by North Point Press. For more information, check on the web at mcdonough.com. Again, that's mcdonough.com. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.